Psychiatry by Marku Lindroos. I sit here, preparing for my session with Helen. There are several issues at hand, some of them severe. She has been under immense strain over the past 2 years, and a year ago she was even admitted to a psychiatric facility for a few days. They found her difficult to cooperate with there, as she viewed her stay at the clinic purely as a period of rest. Perhaps that was exactly what she needed most at the time. At the very least, it served as a much-needed warning sign to those around her regarding her condition. I have looked into the details as thoroughly as possible and primed myself to maintain a strictly professional attitude. Usually, I am not this meticulous, but in this case, it is vital in order to distance myself from our personal history. I feel both anticipation and dread toward the upcoming conversation, but I am not particularly nervous, nor am I overthinking it. On the contrary, I feel heavy and exhausted, shivering in the grip of an oncoming flu. I know I'm about to push my endurance further than is good for me. I know Helen all too well from our past, and I know I must have a solid framework for how this conversation unfolds. I also need to make her realize that this is a collaborative effort. Both parties must know how to listen, ask, wait, and receive. I welcome the challenge, but I am terrified of failing. This gets my adrenaline pumping, though not to the extent that it poses a threat to the success of the session. The primary goal is to get her on board on my terms, without losing sight of her best interests. I write down a few fundamental, open-ended questions so I won't forget anything important, and I try to anticipate some of her responses. In my mind's eye, I try to map out a path forward from there, as if I were playing a game of chess from a specific opening position, exploring every possible countermove in advance. I take a few deep breaths and figure I will manage. Otherwise, I would have cancelled the session. I check the clock and log the starting point of the meeting into my patient management software. I am becoming increasingly focused on the task at hand. This is, after all, the first time I am meeting a friend with these kinds of issues, in such a deliberate, pre-planned manner. When she called, I wondered why she wanted to reach out to me of all people. Familiarity can be highly problematic in a therapeutic setting, but I couldn't refuse to hear her out. There is a knock at the door. I save my temporary session log and ask her to come in. I can read her nervousness in the twitchy, fleeting shifts of her expression and a trace of burgeoning hysteria, but otherwise she looks just as soulful and beautiful as always. At first, I try to adopt a light, familiar tone. Hi, good to see you. It's been a while since we last crossed paths. How are John and the kids doing? I get no answer. She merely looks at me, head tilted, with an expression that makes it clear she hasn't come to chat about her family, but because of her own problems. I decide to shift immediately into a more professional gear. I say, "Have a seat, please." She obeys mechanically. I commit the detail to memory, unsure whether it reflects a conscious effort to suppress a volcanic eruption or a state of resigned psychotic depression. I realize she won't be capable of a normal conversation right away, and I fear I am failing. I ask if I may take notes during our conversation, placing particular emphasis on the word conversation. Suddenly, she seems to snap out of it and says, "Fuck off, Birgit. I'm not crazy and I'm not a child. I'm only here because John wanted me to come. Lately, I've had a bit of trouble staying motivated with my work, and out of frustration, I've been taking my anger out on John. Because of that, I owe him this much and I'm doing what he wants. That's all." "I see," I say. "Could you elaborate on that a little and give me something concrete? Perhaps you feel the root of your problems lies just as much with John, since you brought him up." Maybe what you two need is family therapy rather than my individual therapeutic help. I am consciously trying to downplay her perception of my expertise so that when the right moment comes, I can wriggle out of this using some professional pretext. John isn't the cause of this, she says sharply. John is fine. John is always fine. And I don't care if he strays sometimes, sleeps around, and drinks to take the edge off his work pressures. He loves me. That's enough. She looks down at the floor, not even believing her own reassurances. And I sense that we are at the very core of her troubles. Yet I don't dare to probe any deeper just yet. We must constantly breathe at her pace and advance according to her capacity to process it. She is intelligent and can see the true causal links even in painful matters, provided the pressure caused by her frustration eases a little and I can manage to bring them out in a visual form. The trick, after all, is to project the problems in their proper proportions relative to everything else, to confine the emotional torrent to what is essential and therefore more manageable. I often view myself as an interpreter, and that is perhaps the very foundation of my counselling method. Naturally, I prescribe medication when necessary and refer patients to proper psychiatric care if severe mental illness or brain trauma is involved. Granted, I sometimes doubt whether I am always doing the right thing. Even severe chemical imbalances in the brain can occasionally be temporary disruptions triggered by the mind, presenting symptoms identical to chronic mental illnesses caused by genetics or physical trauma. I try to push my deductions into the background and focus on the flow of the conversation. I ask, "What about your work, Helen? I've heard about your upcoming exhibition, and I can hardly wait." "It's coming along. I always have enough in reserve for at least one show. The problem is that the fumes from the varnish drive me mad, and I can't always concentrate well enough." She chuckles, noticing her own use of the word mad, and continues almost cheerfully, "But I don't know how to stop. I try to force myself to hold on to an idea. And if I let go, it's gone forever." I often find myself standing there late into the night, staring at the spot of the very last brushstroke, unable to go on. Then John drags me half by force to bed, and if he's drunk, he wants to fuck. I can't get into it, and while he's pumping into me from behind, all I can think about is that goddamn spot on the canvas. Tell me, Birgit, am I truly crazy? "No, you're not," I reply, caught off guard. I am her captive, and my pre-planned roadmap for this conversation is completely lost. I try to pull myself together. I cannot allow myself to be swept away so easily by her stream of words, nor can I let her narratives carry me along. "Have you tried anti-anxiety medication?" I ask, adopting my most clinical manner to steer the conversation back into its proper channel. I want to control the dialogue and myself. "No, but sometimes I smoke a bit of weed if someone happens to have some, but getting high always frightens me, even while everyone else is giggling and I have to drink myself into a stupor just to make it back to reality. But you know how that is, don't you?" She is noticeably calmer now. But I remain cautious, wondering how much longer I should continue the session. There are too many layers between us, too much personal history that we are both trying to dance around. I ask a question simply for the sake of asking, "Would you like something mild to help settle your nerves?" I don't dare touch medication. I'm afraid it will kill my creativity. "Ha ha, you understand, the great female artist." She laughs forcedly, a slight edge of bitterness in her voice. She's achieved international success, Several of her major pieces hang in the lobbies of prominent buildings and in modern art museums in major cities all over the world. I realise I am envious of Helen. I feel my grip slipping. And only now do I truly notice that the woman sitting before me is a revered, brilliant artist. I hope my thoughts don't show, because that would completely upend the power dynamics of this room. I am surprised by her coherence and the way she is able to adopt a bird's eye view to observe herself. I had expected much worse. In our past encounters, I thought I had occasionally caught wild glints in her eyes that hinted at a slight fragmentation of the mind, perhaps a split personality. Yet her mental control during this session is absolute, and I downgrade my preliminary diagnosis from a potential borderline case to a recurring life crisis trauma. It exhibits the wandering mental anarchy and social maladjustment so typical of artistic work. Such a state likely stems from the inward-looking nature of creativity and the intense focus on one's own mental imagery. During the creative process, the external world becomes nothing more than a dimly lit backdrop, where the internal drama unfolds through associations with the themes of the piece in progress. Creativity can be an abyss that sucks you into its depths, blurring outer reality. I smile to myself at the sudden poetic turn of my thoughts, an indulgence that evaporates the instant I think of John. That goddamn pig needs a different kind of treatment than what I can provide. I sigh involuntarily. I'm afraid I have exposed myself. The rapid shifts in my expression must be like a canvas, revealing the thoughts shining through the cracks of my ruined professionalism. Helen can't know. At least that is what I tell myself as I try, in a mild panic, to recover my default composure. Ridiculous as it sounds, I have occasionally practiced expressions in front of the mirror, aiming to use them deliberately to guide conversations with my patients. Helen watches me scrutinizingly and says, "Are you not feeling well, doctor?" "No need to worry, my mind wanders sometimes. I was just thinking that goddamn John probably isn't of much help to you." I watch her curl in on herself as she says faintly, "John is writing again and drinking, looking for inspiration for his stories elsewhere. He doesn't hit me or anything like that, but he knows how to be cruel." She underscores the point by repeating herself, her voice verging on fierce. "Never anything physical. If he abuses me, it's with his insatiable desire. I forgive him for it because my conscience is always heavy, and because I don't want him constantly running off to find other women." Helen ponders for a moment. I say nothing, allowing her to process her relationship with John, trying for the time being not to think about the conflict between them. Helen continues, measuring me with her eyes. "But you wouldn't understand how truly I love John, or the fact that he has sacrificed his entire life for me. His stupid flings and other antics mean nothing. John always explains that he needs experiences to be able to write, and I understand that, even if deep down I can't accept that he goes to bed with someone else just because I don't have time for his desires. Sometimes I'm envious. I'd like to have experiences too, but I know it would mean an immediate end to us. His fragile self-esteem couldn't take it. Perhaps there's some kind of biological male instinct at play. The need to be certain of his offspring or something. I suppose you know more about those kinds of things." Helen begins to sob from the pressure of her sudden release. It is a good development, but I am sweating and growing tired. I must have a fever again. I feel truly awful, and I decide to end it here. I say, shall we call it a day? We could meet tomorrow if you'd like to talk some more. Helen looks at me, startled and anxious. Is that all there is to your doctoring then? I smile to myself. The best tool in talk therapy is often the act of termination. The door is already ajar, and the patient can see the healing light filtering through the crack. When the therapist then bluntly announces that the session is over and slams the door shut, the patient scrambles to get a foot in the door. It forces them to confront their situation and carry it with them as a sort of homework for the next time. In this situation, I always doubt what I should do, but the rule is nevertheless to remain categorical. If a patient cannot withstand the pressure of their current reality and shatters completely, they require a different level of care. Mere talk therapy is no longer appropriate at that stage. Uncontrolled traumatic after effects can emerge with fatal consequences. Suicides do happen sometimes due to a misjudged therapeutic encounter. That is why I am particularly careful to assess Helen's state. Even though we haven't ventured very deep into the hotbeds of her problems and have almost mutually avoided the real issues, I have failed because I didn't concentrate enough and spent too much time reflecting on my own reactions. We agree on a new appointment at my initiative, and I am surprised that she doesn't write it down or say a word. Shrugging my shoulders, I note the time down on a slip of paper and hand it to her. We finish the meeting by chatting in a light tone as friends, discussing everyday women's matters, as if the rendezvous had no other purpose. I feel relieved because throughout the entire conversation, Helen was noticeably clearer in her thoughts and more grounded than I had dared to hope. I also consider that we have made some headway in managing the situation. The need to tighten my professional grip is also less pressing than I anticipated. I finally relax, thinking that Helen isn't in an immediate crisis after all. All in all, I am quite pleased with the outcome of the conversation. Helen waits patiently while I quickly review my notes one last time and write down, almost triumphantly, I didn't get swept away by her stream of words, nor did I let Helen's will carry me along. I was able to guide her onto the right tracks, and a few times I felt her show genuine trust. She was also calm in her speech and expressions, and she perceived a clear connection between the things she spoke about. Her deductions aren't as bound to her immediate situation as I feared. Smart girl. As she's already standing up, I say aloud, as a kind of comforting summary of the session. It always feels heavy if you view your problems as one giant solid wall. That's why it's better to take on one problem at a time. At the same time, I think to myself that I still need to practice this. Perhaps I let too many things surface all at once. It isn't easy to find the right footing immediately when dealing with acquaintances. One is forced to try to forget matters tied to personal relationships and focus on the core of the problem as a detached outsider. That seems well nigh impossible in this case. Of course, there is an advantage to knowing a patient so intimately in private life. It spares you the exhausting cat-and-mouse game of fishing out external details. I am certain that next time we can focus on continuing the talk-based therapy for a short while, until I find a suitable opening to slip away and refer her elsewhere. Perhaps Eric would take her on as a patient. Then again, no. That fool is obviously in love with Helen as it is. I'll think of someone else. Anyone but my husband. I am proud of my competence and of the fact that I managed to keep my secret affair with John entirely out of my thoughts, as if it didn't even exist. I didn't hurt myself, nor did I devolve into a subconscious war between females. John told me he no longer sleeps with Helen unless he is blackout drunk, and that all feelings between them are dead anyway. I am, however, a bit disappointed by the lies John told me, which came to light during the session. On the other hand, I feel a feminine satisfaction, knowing I have gained a weapon for our future arguments. Helen stands up fully and walks with a surprising air of determination toward the door. She stops, turns around with theatrical slowness, and says with a practiced lightness, "I won't be coming back for another session, and John won't be coming back to your bed." She pauses briefly, studying my stunned expression, and continues, "We've talked things through, using real names, and life goes on. Send the bill in my name. I'll send you an invitation to the exhibition as soon as the date is set." With a melancholy smile, she closes the door between us for good, and she is gone. I find the morphine in the medicine cabinet. My hands fumble with the syringe, but I manage to draw a second ampoule into the chamber. I am completely calm. The dose is sufficient. I slide the needle into my vein.